What is Debbie's husband's name? And give me a little background on him.
Okay, Dennis Ross is his name.
R-O-S-S?
Yes, you understand, my children keep their own names. All of women in my family keep their own names. So we have a bunch of names in this family. He is from New York.
New York City?
New York City. He's a graduate of Queens College, New York. And Hebrew Union College.
Did they meet at Hebrew Union?
At Hebrew Union College. And as he tells the story, nobody knew who he was until he started dating Debbie. They have a great, great relationship. They're friends.
And where is his...
Dennis is now the rabbi of the congregation in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. He is the senior rabbi. He's the only rabbi there. Before that, they had lived in Washington, but he did not want to be an assistant anymore. So he went on his own, got that congregation. It's about 280 families, and he is his own king. He's running his own show, and Debbie runs a part-time congregation in Great Barrington. She is the chaplain at Williams College.
Great Barrington.
She has about 130 families in hers, and it's a part-time lady. A lot of them are people from Westchester Reform who have homes up in the Berkshires.
Oh, is this the Berkshires?
Right. It's God's country. It's gorgeous.
And Williams College, she is the chaplain?
She's a Jewish chaplain up there. To distinguish it from Hillel. You should see their building. It would make the University of Pittsburgh drool with envy. The most beautiful Jewish center I have ever seen. Better than one of the grand mice.
What do they have? A large Jewish...
I think about 250 Jewish kids. That's all. You know that Williams at one time, the only way a Jew got into Williams is he won his way.
Colleges.
Didn't know a lot in those days, but today it's an open school and it's a great place and she loves it. And the children there love her, the students there love her. Debbie is great. I guess I talk about her. I take a lot of pride in what they've done with their lives. The best story I will give you about Debbie, she was at Hebrew Union College. She came home on a visit and she went to services at our temple. It was on the anniversary of her bar mitzvah, and the rabbi asked her to do the Zohar Torah. Now, I always thought she had talent, but I never knew that kid who was up there talking, because I asked my wife, and so I asked Stephen at the time, who the hell is she?
She was a speech that she gave.
She gave a speech, and she conducted the major part of the service. You have to understand, Temple David has the unique distinction of being responsible for more rabbis in the shortest period of time than any congregation in the area. Two of them are my daughters, the Zabarenko, the Bergs, Wolf, Stephanie Wolf is now being ordained. We have a lot of people coming out of that congregation. A lot of it has to do with Jason Edelstein. He's a hell of a teacher.
I've heard of him too.
There's no question he is a rabbi in the best sense of the word. When they were in youth group, they used to write the services. They were better than anything the adults ever put on.
This could go on and on. I mean, we have to do Jason Edelstein.
Well, yes, you should. You should do him.
Maybe he's done. I don't know.
If you get him, you're lucky.
All right, so now we have Debbie all settled in Pittsfield, Mass.
Elaine,
6 years is a lot of difference.
Yes, but they're as close as if they were twins. My children, I have the good fortune of having my children having each other as their best friends. They talk to each other, they probably talk to each other at least twice a week. They visit, there's an annual visit where they all go to one home for a week around Christmas time. And they always get together. They sometimes go on vacation together. Rita and I do not impose ourselves into that relationship. That's what we think together.
And include your son in his life.
Susan, no question. She's part of the family.
Okay, all right, now Elaine, so let's get the...
Elaine is the politician of the family. Elaine was president of the youth group. Elaine was president of PAFTI, the reform movement in Pennsylvania and in the state of Pennsylvania. Elaine was the leader at Brandeis and everything conceivable. She was the valedictorian at Brandeis.
Mm-hmm.
And she has a mind of her own. She has changed prayer books and made them non-sexist. She will not do anything about God being a masculine person. There's no question about these kids. Slight digression. My famous story of the first Women's Day Parade in New York City. We were up in New York that time, all Rita and I and the three kids. And we were watching.
Which would have been when?
Oh, God, they were youngsters at the time. Someplace in the 60s, I would say. Middle 60s. I think I was here at the, I was here at the Chronicle Radio at that point. And we were watching the parade, and Rita realized what the parade was. She took the three kids and said, "We're marching." I said, "I'm not marching. We're marching." At that point, the lesbian group marched by. I said, "Could you at least wait?" Okay, fine.
Okay.
Okay, that gives you an idea of the liberated world they grew up in. And the stories I used to tell them of my mother, it had a profound effect on them. Elaine had her own mind as to what she wanted to do. She decided early that she did not want to become a pulpit rabbi. There were a lot of demands for her as a pulpit rabbi. She had a big struggle with the hierarchy at the union because she refused to be put on any of the panels. And she fought them to a standstill. She said at the time it was not part of the entrance requirement that she go on a panel. She was not going to go on a panel.
But you mean go on a panel to have a...
To be interviewed for a pulpit job. They said if you don't want a pulpit job but you still go on a panel, then you can decide what you want to do. Said no. They said they will not help her find a position. She wanted to live in the Boston area at the time. She went out and found her own position as the education director of the Jewish Community Center in Boston.
Was she single?
She was single all this time. She is a single purpose individual. She tells me what to do, and I used to do it. She's incredible. And then she met David.
Talk about David.
David, you have the story of how they met. That's part of, this is part of the whole deal. Kushner, Lawrence Kushner, was her rabbi. Since she didn't have a congregation, she joined his congregation. He is the Jewish mystic. Probably have heard about him in his books. This guy is really...
Why do bad things happen to good people?
It's his cousin who wrote that.
Oh.
He writes on... He's a Kabbalah in the Reform movement. That is a really an oxymoron if you want to get one.
I saw it on Tuesday.
Okay, that's his whole shtick. That's the world he lives in. Okay. He conducted Torah classes on Shabbos. And Elaine used to go to them. And this one particular Shabbos, she was there and David was there. They never knew one another. And he conducted the discourse. And as he got up to walk out to go to the main service, as he reached the door, he told the story at their wedding, so I can repeat it. He turned around, went back to David and said, "Do you see that beautiful one sitting there with the gray hair? Elaine has all gray hair at this time. She's single. She's a rabbi." And
is David a rabbi?
No, David is a doctor.
Medical doctor.
At this point, I better tell you about him. David was the first...
What's his last name?
Heisenberg. He was at TISBG. He was the first exchange student with China in the medical school program. He lived in China for a year and a half, developed a concept of what Chinese medicine was all about, became an expert on it, in it, came back on his degree. And
where did he get his degree?
Harvard.
We're not going to have any small potatoes here.
Well, not this guy. He became an expert in non-conventional medicine. He's a teacher now at Harvard. He has a practice, but that's not the main thing. He's basically a researcher. And if you remember, Bill Moyers did a program.
I was just thinking, I have the tapes.
You have the tape? David is the one on Chinese medicine. David is the one that took Moyer through China.
That was fascinating.
That's my son-in-law. And he's great to go to a Chinese restaurant with. Fantastic. That's another story. So they have a great working relationship. At that point, Elaine decided that the politics of non-congregational life was beyond her. And since she was a rabbi, and social workers looked at rabbis in the same sense that they looked at secretaries. So she said, hell with that. She wanted to get a pulpit. She became the assistant rabbi at Temple Israel in Boston, which is right in the heart of the medical area.
Temple Israel.
Right.
She's an assistant.
She's the assistant rabbi there. I guess they'll keep her. She has a job for life if she wants it. She wants to raise her child. She had a baby, thank God. She lost one. That's why I was saying thank God. Jacob and their whole world revolves around that little boy. And she cut back on her hours, but she still, they won't let her go. And she's raising her family. In fact, she was written up in the Jewish Telegraphic Agency on spiritual healing. They did a story on that, so she was one of the people that they referred to in that. That she got conveyed on. They're remarkable families. Each one of those three kids are remarkable.
Certainly are.
They like each other. God. You see, in our family, I try to inculcate my children with the idea there is no dual morality. What is good for one is good for the other.
No dual
morality. What the woman can't do, the man can do. It does not work in our family. Mm-hmm. What's good for one is good for them. And our kids practice that very. My children used to tell me that I used to tell them that they should not be ashamed of being different. And my kids said, that's not the problem. We're the square. We are the different ones. The rest of them are all square because what they do, we don't do. Now, I don't doubt it might have been some time in my kids' life. They might have experimented with some of the more quiescent drug. I think they must have. I don't know. I don't know. I never asked. We never ran our home as being a place where there was a lack of experimentation intellectually. We never said no to them. I guess this story could be one thing for you. I don't know whether you want this one thing. When the Supreme Court knocked out the prohibition on books of a sexual nature, I always heard about Fannie Hill. Now, Fannie Hill does not have one profane word in it. It describes stuff in rather vivid detail, but there's nothing profane. It's not a dirty book. And my daughter, Debbie, picked it up, and Rita and I had a rule. Whatever they read, they read. And a friend of my daughter's, my wife's, saw Debbie reading the book and grabbed it from her. And my wife said, give her the goddamn book back. Rita, tell them what they can read and what they can't. I have very conservative children, so it didn't hurt letting them see what the world is like. Now, my children will tell me that I'm a revisionist, that things are not as rosy as I say they were, but from my point of view, they were. From their point of view, might not, but that's okay. We still love one another.
You certainly can be very.
That's what
counts,
too.
Yeah, I am. Okay, you pick it up. Where do you want to go?
Well, I do think that we'll keep this session to the family and to religious, and then we'll do one next week on your Jewish press type things, because that's important.
That will be less free will if they have to.
Yes, well.
Understand the restrictions a little bit.
Of course. Let's go back to your employment. Give me sort of a chronological.
When I got out of the Air Force, I had every intention of going back to law school. In fact, I had been readmitted to law school. I got out in December of 53. Thank God Eisenhower, who allowed a reduction in force, and that's a story in itself, because they didn't want to let me out, because I was an essential classification. I had a commanding officer who was my buddy, and I was the last guy to get out of the Air Force in 1953. Reduction in force, less than. And I had to stay in the ready reserves for 8 years, which is another thing.
So you were in the reserves?
Oh yeah, I was in the reserves.
Why were you essential?
Well, one of the other jobs I had in the Air Force is that I did a certain amount of security work as part of my teaching. They didn't want to let me go. I thought there was a certain malevolence in their part. But that was okay.
In the Air Force, I think you told me before, but let's review. How long were you in the Air Force?
3 years.
And actually, what was
I had enlisted for 4, I got out in 3.
And what was your actual duty there? You were teaching?
I was an information specialist, supervisor.
And then what did you send to Padua?
Padua,
I typed it up last night.
And so when they allowed you to leave at the end of 3,
I had every intention. I wanted to go back to law school. Rita and I decided that with the GI Bill, I could go back to school. She would be working. This is before we had children. And I had applied. And you remember Charles Nutting at Pitt? Charles Nutting was the acting chancellor after Fitzgerald left. He and I had become very close friends because of the relationship I had with the university, with my Air Force connections. And he said, you're admitted back to law school. Fine, okay. I needed the job. There was a guy at Pitt by the name of Chuck Ebert, who was in charge of student placement.
Chuck Ebert?
E-B-E-R-T. And I went to him for a job. And he said, what can you do? I said, well, what I did in the Air Force, I cannot do in civilian life. He said, well, what jobs have you ever had? I told him I'd never worked any place except for my father's store in sales. And he sold fruit. Never had another job. He said, well, since I also worked at the newspaper in the Air Force, he said, can you sell ads? I said, I can sell any damn thing. And thank you. So then he said, there's a company called Reuben H. Donnelly that sells telephone advertising. Then before he could finish, he said, but they don't hire Jews in Pittsburgh. No kidding.
That's all he had to hear.
He said, get me an appointment. He said, I have to tell them you're Jewish. I said, I don't give a damn what you tell them. I thought, tell them I'm coming to see them on an interview and I want to have it today. I went there and I was hired.
It wasn't that they were worried about, at that point, that was 19, what?
That was 54.
January
54.
Civil rights,
no such thing.
That didn't come until 60s. He had to convince them somehow. How did you do that?
I found out that I was. I stayed there for 11 years. 10 years. I made money. I never made so much money in my life. For at that time, considering what I came from to what I was going, and I told me, you know what? Law school can wait. I kept putting it off, and then we had Debbie, and then we went out. And actually, I worked for Reuben H. Donnelly. You know, Reuben H. Donnelly at that time was the sales organization for Bell Telephone. Mm-hmm. They were at that time not hiring Jews except in the Bell Laboratories in New Jersey. There was never another Jew in their whole operation. They were part of AT&T. There was a guy that used to come down to American Telephone and Telegraph.
Yeah, did you say they had to use the Bell?
But only at the Bell Laboratory. Only scientists. Nothing in any other field. Nothing dealing with the public. This guy came in to ride with the various sales reps at Lee. When he found out I was Jewish, he went back to the company and said, you have to get rid of that guy. Well, they couldn't get rid of me because I was their leading salesperson. For years, this guy would come in carrying my resignation in his pocket. If he could catch me doing something, anything, he was going to have me out on the street. At that point,
do you have his name, or what was his title?
He was a divisional sales manager. Didn't matter to me.
An anti-Semit.
You know, at that time, I was going to worry.
Did you ever meet him?
Oh, I met him. I used to ride with him.
We mean ride.
He would go out with me to see how I handled myself in front of customers. Once I used the word "new" with a Jewish customer, he turned me in for using ethnic pressure. Phew, I'll never forget that. But they weren't going to fire me locally because I had these guys. But then Rita and I came to the conclusion that I needed a legitimate job. You have to understand, working for Reuben H. Donnelly was the easiest job I ever had in my life. I worked 3 hours a day. It gave me all the time in the world to do all the extracurricular things I wanted to do with Temple David, everything else. We were required to make 4 sales a day. I had in my briefcase no less than 3 weeks of sales that I could portion in any time I wanted.
And when you say sale, it's the yellow pages.
Each ad is considered a sale. You close that sale, that's the sale. I would turn in 4 a day, and that was it. Mm-hmm. Wait for podcasts. Rita said, you better get a job because you're going to have to send 3 kids to college. At the time, I knew Joe Feldman, who was Feldman, Pond & Sutton. Remember Joe Feldman? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I always thought I looked like a Jew. I acted like a Jew. But Joe said, when he realized I was Jewish, he said, I want to offer you a job. Where? Because I was going out on job interviews at the time. And he said, at the Jewish Chronicle. I said, what is that? And he said, it's the Jewish paper in town. And I said, that is the backside of anything that I want to do. They're nothing but blackmailers, these guys. They're a despicable type of sales. They use everything that I find abhorrent. Would you give it a year? Okay. I was a glutton. I went to a friend of mine, Ralph Zabarenko by name. I told him I was. Did you know Zabarenko's?
Yeah,
Lucy?
Music, yeah.
Lucy. Okay. Oh, yeah. Lucy's husband. Ralph is now dead. And we had lunch, and I told him I was taking this job in the Jewish community, and he said, it's the best thing in the world for you. I said, why? He said, because you love Jews and you don't love money.
When you say this, you said, what is the Jewish Chronicle? Before that, you were not familiar with it.
I remember the criteria, the outlook on. Mm-hmm. See, when I said, what is the Jewish Chronicle? What? The Jewish Chronicle for me? I should go there?
I see. You knew what it was.
To me, it was nothing. So I came here.
What year was that?
1964. Al Bloom was here at the time. And Al Golan was here at the time. Okay, I'll save that part for later on in the relationship. I came in here as a salesman. In 4 months, they made me advertising manager. And then I was designated as Al Golub's successor. There was a intense animosity between Al Golub and Al Bloom. And my job was to work between the two of them. Al Golub, whatever Al Bloom wanted to do, Al Golub wanted. It was the most spiteful, hateful place in the world to work in.
Well, I know who Al Bloom was. He was the editor. Golub was the business manager.
He was the business manager. He was the former owner of the Outlook, and he had an employment contract when they bought up the paper. We'll go into the history of the paper. Like the stuff that I can't tell you, I will tell you. Al Golub came in as part of that deal. Al Golub had a heart attack. It was precipitated by a board meeting that was probably the most virulent exchange between two grown men that I've ever been party to. And he died a month after that, and I was put in as business manager. Al Bloom wanted to be made head of the paper, but it was not in the cards for him because he didn't know how to add one and one to help with anything other than the other. He's a great guy, wonderful person, good family man. He did not know how to run a paper. That was my job.
Well,
My job is to come in here and make this thing work. The Federation obligated itself to pay off the purchase of these two papers to the tune of $307,500. They never allocated a dollar to pay off those papers to the two former owners. When I came in, the Chronicle was losing that year about $80,000 a year, which was coming. Somebody had to make that money good. So I had to turn them around.
That's going to be a big story.
Yeah. 21.
Okay. At this point, and before we get into it, you are now pulling away. You are retiring, or what? I mean, or what?
Okay. It was my decision that I wanted to have my successor here. I knew the track record of having search committees bring in somebody from the outside who did not know the community. When Barbara Befferman came to work for the Chronicle 9 years ago, I felt that she had the potential to be my successor. You understand that no woman has ever succeeded to the job of head of an agency from within this time. They brought women in, but they never came from within the organization. They came from without. Barbara was the person I wanted for this job. I guess I should go into part of the reason for this is my own medical history. I have had 2 quadruple bypasses.
That's good. Let's get your medical history and save all the business for the next time.
Okay.
All right. Let's do the medical.
Okay. Starting at what point? Beginning?
Well, I mean, when did you have any big problems?
I had brought to the Chronicle certain inheritance like primary tuberculosis and
his childhood history.
I had pneumonia something like 8 times.
And no, were there antibiotics out at that time?
Not for my little problem.
When you say that, was as a child did you have, you had the TB as a child?
See, I was lucky. Primary tuberculosis you can get. It doesn't have to develop into full-scale tuberculosis. What will happen is that a lesion will develop on the lung and it will calcify over. It's like a self-healing process within the body. A lot of people in Pittsburgh have primary tuberculosis. They may be unaware of it, but they found that I had it when I was in the Air Force. My mother always thought it was pneumonia.
Is that from the environment
here? It could have been. For all I know, it could have been. It was rather interesting. I was being discharged. They wouldn't discharge me because they said, we can't let you out because you have tuberculosis. We can find out when you have it. That was a little shock in my life, I want you to know.
That's the first that you realized.
That's the first I realized I ever had it. I knew I had pneumonia everlasting. But in those days, you know, with my parents, they didn't know what pneumonia was. And this is a side note on it. All the childhood diseases that we would have, in those days, you used to go into quarantine.
Right.
My family couldn't afford to go into quarantine because they were running a business. So they had never told anybody. Oh, yeah. I'm going to tell you something. It was fascinating. Unfortunately, I didn't infect the world. I was kept in my room and I stayed there. With chicken soup. I had a mastoid as a kid. I nearly died from that. When I came to the Chronicle, okay, with all, you know, all the other diseases, fine. I had a proclivity to kidney stones. I passed more kidney stones. I could go to mountain kidney stones. And then in 1980, I came down. Actually, 1982, the week of my son's wedding, I knew I had a problem.
Another minute.
I had difficulty walking up Murdoch Road. Could not walk up that hill. I knew I had a problem. I didn't say anything. I waited till Stephen was married. And then I went to my doctor and took the stress test. I flunked it. Then I took the thallium stress test and I flunked that royally. And they put me in for the catheterization. They found that I had 4 blockages. I was operated on, and fortunately, it was a successful operation.
Okay, we'll stop.